Hello, this is John Young, and I'm here with my dear brother and co-conspirator in culture repair, Mark Morey, who I'm woefully out of touch with, but know that we are brothers on the same path, and really grateful, Mark, for you saying yes to talking to me for a few minutes about culture repair, the 512 Project, and what you're doing, and your thoughts on all of this. And when we were just chatting, you were referencing some things that were just like, I'm like, oh man, I wish we were recording this, but maybe we can just catch some of it again. But what's happening with you, Mark Morey?
Well, we have the annual ritual of maple syrup season here in Vermont, and it's already doing its magic. Saves me every late winter, gets me outside, pulling wood out of the forest, sitting by a fire, boiling sap in the pan.
Nice.
You know, I bring my laptop out there, but it's just not the same when a chickadee flies up, you know, and each year, you know, I feel more grateful to see this beautiful thing moving around, singing its spring song one more time. And this year, special, Lucia came and boiled with me, and that's my daughter, she's 16, and brought her first boyfriend. So sat by the fire with the two of them telling stories, and, you know, life continues that way in this kind of timeless annual manner. So good.
Well, that is one of the cultural elements that we talk about, these gratitude rituals that all of our ancestors had that were seasonal and that were really, in a way, designed to connect people to place, to each other, you know, that timelessness around the fire and all the goodness that comes from that. So it's really appropriate that you're referencing that and putting that around us. You know, I'm feeling the snow and the maple trees, and here I am in California, it's sunny, and our maples, I don't think, are doing the same thing yours are. but I'm so grateful for the maple syrup that my children look so forward to on their French toast or their waffles in the morning. And yeah, the delight and joy that it brings. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were just talking, Mark, before we started recording about, you know, the recipe book, you know, that the 512 Project is really a recipe card file, and people really will always just apply the recipes the way they do. And even if you had a big fat recipe book with 512 recipes in it, you'd never think to grab all 512 and cook them one day at a time. But your favorites would be in there, and you might once in a while look for something new and put it in there. But you're going to basically add your favorite ingredients and do it the way you like to do it, because it brings joy to you and your family. And, you know, we were saying that if we had written this as a book years ago, we would have had to rewrite it 20 years later, because things are always changing and people need to apply this stuff differently. And then you referenced the Young Man's Rite of Passage project that you're working on. And I would love for you to speak to some of the things that you were saying to me about that.
Yeah, we were talking about, eventually you're going to improvise anyway. And I suppose the cookbook metaphor really works, because if you don't have a lineage of intuitive, embedded relationship to food, if, like myself, for example, my family lost touch with making food, growing food, and, you know, we're in the canned food, frozen food, boxed food, packaged food era for quite a long time. And so, you know, improvising with food isn't necessarily something that's coming off of the shoulders of ancestral wisdom. So in bringing back cultural elements like rites of passage for adolescents, you know, we have a whole sensitivity here with the human development. And so improvising isn't the first thing that's recommended. So we have, you know, a well-developed process of bringing youth into awareness and respect for themselves and others. And so when men come to learn the ceremony so they can run it in their communities, we begin with the opposite of improvisation, which is, you know, following instruction and paying attention to the patterns that have been coming before them and getting rigorous with that instruction. And that way, they're balancing that future development with the wisdom of the people who've come before them.
Yep, and the need to be rigorous at first, especially with some of these. I mean, you know, we can be lighter with a greeting custom and be more improvisational almost from the beginning, but some of these other deeper cultural elements are about us breaking our own habits, not just helping the youth that we're serving with a cultural element, because we didn't maybe get that. You know, as you were saying, boxed foods and canned foods, you know, similar in my life story, I didn't have the initiation and rite of passage in that same way, you know, and maybe many of us haven't had that. So we don't really know how to do it for the young people because it wasn't done for us. And I think that's the important part of holding that line tight when we're first learning some of these things, right?
Exactly. And
yep.
Having relationships to those people. I've worked with the word submit, you know, as a way of expressing submitting my ideas, my ego, my want, the I-ness of this generation to the we and the collective and the intelligence that's come before. And, you know, as a form of humility, saying, you know, I'm willing to listen and learn and not have it be about me being special. And so that's a threshold for people in learning these things. I noticed that it could bounce some people out, and that's okay.
Yeah, I think sometimes we have to be bounced out, right? Bounced out and sit with it for a bit and then come back around when we're ready, you know,
yeah,
especially with
exactly.
Some of these things. So it has its time.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I you know, some hazard stories about that yesterday because people are like, well, why all these agreements? Why can't we just do this on our own? I said, well, you know, this is about really reclaiming the depth of what it means to be facilitating youth development into a culture of connection and a relationship to themselves and their place in the world. So it's not something that happens lightly like a birthday party. And you
right.
know, there's nuances in there that aren't seen at first, just like someone who's entering the woods, the fields, the mountaintops, they don't see the nuances. You know, they don't see the subtleties of what's going on in the fabric of nature. It takes those nuanced eyes to guide them, you know, so you're not stepping on things or negating things or coming up with simple ways of navigating that actually could get yourself or other people hurt because you can't see yet.
Right. Yeah, it's a really good metaphor. And I was thinking about yesterday, you know, you were talking about that we, that collective, and, you know, what is that? And I was down in San Luis Obispo with the Outside Now community, and we were talking about, you know, the unity principle, you know, why learning to get into unity with a group of people really matters as a way of conduct, because it isn't really about agreeing or setting aside our beliefs and, you know, adopting another's beliefs. It's really about finding that space where we all come together in that feeling of oneness, you know, that felt sense of, hey, this is working, we're connected, I feel better in this moment. And that what we're really doing is accessing the grand creativity that's flowing through everything, you know, and that collective, that we-ness is at the heart of all this, right? It's kind of what we lost in modern times. You know, we're not aware of that subtle field. But it's such an important one for our times, and it's where vision and hope comes from, really, when we're in touch with that. So that's a great thing to bring up. And I something that was brought to my attention in the last couple of weeks that you had done and posted in social media, Mark, was that you had kind of counted the numbers of people who were early adopters of applying cultural elements, you know, doing culture repair. I think you had identified somewhere around 25 or 50 centers, you know, on a map, and you had said that basically through this group of people, we had affected 25,000 youth or something like that in a positive way. And I don't know that people really realize what that means, you know, like how positive that really is. And yesterday we had a 13-year-old boy named Sage who's grown up in one of these communities that's working with cultural elements called Outside Now down there in San Luis Obispo. And they were one of the early adopter groups, you know, from 15 years of work there in that community. And here's this young boy, you know, 13, in front of a group of adults, many of whom he doesn't know. And he's given the gratitude for the day. and the way he's speaking, the way he's holding himself, the way he's addressing his childlike wonder and love of trees and water and how special it is, you know, because he's living on the coast, so he's talking about even how great it is to get in the water, you know, and play in the waves, you know, and he's really bringing it. And people were so moved by this young man's ability to hold that space, you know, and he is not just like a smart kid who's, you know, got something, oh, he's doing better in school kind of thing. It's so much more than that. There's this whole field of energy and conduct around him that was so inspiring to the many people in the room who had gray hair who hadn't seen that before in a young person, you know. And, you know, to imagine, you know, if hundreds of communities adopted this kind of process and started working with each other in their own ways of innovation and commitment, what could happen, you know? And I just wondered if you'd speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, can I give you the actual numbers that I came up with?
Yes, please. Yes.
So it's not necessarily the early adopters. It's current organizations that identify as being run as an Age Shields or inspired by Age Shields or the art of mentoring. So they self-identify using those terms. And so 75 organizations said yes, they do, currently in the United States and into the borders of Canada, you know, in Ontario and the BC areas mostly. And these groups / communities concurrently serve 55,000 unique people each year.
Mm.
So something like 35,000 of them are youth, 15 or so are adults, and they, you know, a lot of them have been running for 15 years, you know, so we're talking about 500,000 people easy have been exposed to this, and the oldest ones are generating, you know, youth who are now far into their adulthood, upwards of, well, the youth you mentored, right, are in their 40s, but, you know, a good chunk of them that were the next generation, there's probably 5,000, 10,000 youth between 25 and 35 years old. So these are people who are feeling politically active and responsible for the world. They're that young boy times 20 more years. Not times, but adding 20 more years. So they're really having that heat of wanting to do something about it, and they're embedded as leaders in a lot of their communities.
Yeah.
So what I like to imagine with this is that what's different is taking the time to raise youth developmentally in nature is akin to like babies being in the arms of their mother. And they've done some crazy experiments where children were not in physical proximity or in touch with their mother, and, you know, it created like a neurosis, right? It drove them crazy.
Yep.
And so human beings, I believe, have a developmental need to be raised intimately in the natural world, not as entertainment or exercise, but belonging there as kin through the relationship of their family and community as well. So it's part of belonging. And in that way, we have an orientation and a spirit in us that, well, would drive a very different relationship between humans and nature that we're not seeing so much today. So my inspiration currently is to return to mentoring and working with this youth who are 25 to 35 years old, and consider that this is like nature rising, you know, that when we belong to nature, we act in accordance with natural law, with ecology principles, with social justice, because it makes sense, because it's who we are, and that we act more in a collective sense than in an ego, short-term, you know, not thinking about the future generations way.
Mm.
So that's what's calling me in just realizing in the times that we're in, that we have one more layer of adult mentoring to work with, which is how do we help these young people come back together and steer the future in a positive manner? Because I think we can with these cultural elements that you're creating and continuing teaching with them.
Right on. Yep. I was saying to the group yesterday, thank you for that. That has even more impact than I was even thinking. So that was inspiring for me to hear. We created a recipe book that basically says, okay, here's the cultural elements. Here's how we jumpstarted multiple communities to be effective in this in different places. And, you know, we call it Village Builders. And, you know, it's sort of a set of design principles that says, this is the problem we're solving right here. You know, mass disconnection, systemic disconnection in multiple levels of our society and our families and in our everyday within ourselves, you know, and that this is a legacy of disconnection that's gone on for hundreds of years. And it's a big problem. And as you said to me earlier, you know, this is a 200-year plan. You know, it's not something we're going to fix in a day. And, you know, the cultural elements are kind of like recipe cards that give us tools to apply within a framework of, hey, where do I start? How do I get started? What can I do? When after my recording session on Saturday in San Luis Obispo, I went back to my friend Kathleen Lockyer's house to relax for the evening, which is, you know, have dinner and whatnot. And I stood out on this hill in Morro Bay, and I looked out over the rock, which the Chumash, you know, consider a sacred place, and the local native people there. And I was just looking at this beautiful view of the bay and the hills, and I had this picture come into my mind. And it was a picture of people who were gathering these tools pretty much off the internet, you know, and they were in a faraway place that I had never been before. And it was 10 years into the future, and they had just grabbed these recipe cards and they decided to just innovate in their own community working with this. And I visited them 10 years from now after they had been doing this with multiple people in their communities. And I met the youth there that had been influenced by that. And I met the adults and the elders who'd been influenced by it. And, you know, this is not something that I'm asking for or that I even need, but they gave me like a hero's welcome in a way. You know, like they were just like, oh, yeah, you've come to visit us, you know. And there was so much gratitude and joy, and there was so much power in the young people. And I just suddenly realized, wow, you know, if we make these tools available in a much broader way like we are with the 512 Project, it is actually conceivable that people who we may never meet, you or I, could actually innovate with them. You know, it's like learning fiddle tunes off of YouTube, right? You know, then I just had this sudden realization that, you know, these little hands that are reaching up from the earth, all the future generations from all these diverse places who really need people to kind of repair culture would actually be met, you know, that people could treat this as community art. And I just got really excited by that vision.
Yeah.
And I really feel like it's happening, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and the more general and principles-based it is, the more they can adapt it to the fabric that's partially intact for wherever they are, right?
Yep, exactly.
There's always pieces that are strong and pieces that have been lost.
Yep. That's the goal here, just to keep it in a sort of general principle way, give a few examples of how it's applied in some communities and what the effect is on the neurobiology of a human being, you know, what it awakens, what it activates, and then how to apply it. And then basically a few examples of how people in modern times are doing it, but really inviting people to innovate, play with it, and tell us how it's working. You know, that's one of the things that my son Aiden is seeing, you know, like a regular podcast where we get various people from different parts of the world talking about one or two of these elements and really speaking to what it's done for their community or for themselves, you know. In that way, you know, crowdsource the wisdom of all these wonderful creative people, you know, who want to make a difference. So it's exciting.
Yeah, there's powerful implications with all of this that I see that relates to peace and social justice, too, in that when I look through these lenses of cultural elements, I appreciate the depth and richness of other cultures. You know, I appreciate the wisdom and the pieces that are still in place that I've been longing for and missing, which is different than, let's say, taking the things that they do and imitating them. You know, I can still birth authentic, original forms of greeting customs in my place. But when I appreciate other people, then I have this rapport and sense of compassion and also activism, meaning like I show up for other people who maybe are marginalized who do have a lot of these pieces in place still. Because that's the last thing I would want to see is here we are doing this great work, right, because so much has been lost, and yet there are original peoples who have those things and they're just sliding towards the edge of disappearing, right, because we know biodiversity loss is on this crazy curve right now. And an impact of creating regenerative culture through these elements is the preservation of life, the preservation of diversity, both natural and human. So that's the potential that I see coming from this, not just in like making my village stronger as like a resilience lifeboat thing, but that we would preserve and enrich and lift up the ones that still exist because we have the eyes to see now.
Yeah, exactly. And boy, we need a lot more of those eyes, don't we? Especially now.
Yeah.
You know, there was a woman yesterday in the crowd who, I'm sorry?
Yeah, stand shoulder to shoulder, right?
Yep. Because there was a woman yesterday in the crowd who was expressing what I'm sure a lot of people were feeling, and she was just talking about the massive polarization and divisiveness that is emerging, you know. What do we do about that, she said, you know. And I really feel like you just spoke to that, you know. That when we just sort of work in our own way to create more effective conduct for connection, we begin to see conduct for connection. You know, it's like, you know, picturing the color green and then opening your eyes and seeing it everywhere. It's like when we become familiar with, you know, the conduct of connection, we start to understand and appreciate what traditional cultures are holding. And we become friends, allies, really, with the people who are hanging on to the last threads. And we need that. You know, that builds that unity. And, that's the place where we can be effective. I explained that to her, and she seemed satisfied. It is a really challenging time, but this does give us really a lot of hope, you know, and I just really focus my eyes on those people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, as you mentioned, that grew up this way in a place where their parents didn't, and how powerful they are right now, and how, you know, parents who meet them and have children their same age say things like, where are these beautiful young people coming from? And if I had known that this was available for my children when they were growing up, I would have done anything for that because the value of this is tremendous. You know, my children have anxiety disorders, and they're struggling here and they're struggling there, and they don't quite know where to go in life. But these people who are the age of my children are really – they're wholesome and they're powerful, and oh my God, you know, I wish I'd known, right? So I do believe that it is where the hope is. And it's a, you know, as my son Aiden said yesterday to the group of people that were there, this is going to take all of us. You know, we all need to look at this and work in our own way to bring connection back into the fore. So, yeah, well, I think that's good, Mark.
Beautiful.
I just would love people to support the 512 project, you know, on Kickstarter, because we're getting there, you know, about halfway to our goal, and we really appreciate everybody who's supporting it, and maybe we'll get to see you in your community, because our idea is that we have to have 64 unique locations to do these recordings. You know, we want to visit 64 unique communities doing this and have them as the live audience, you know, so
great idea.
Maybe we'll see you in one of those communities, and I'd love to
go on tour.
Yeah, I'd love to do exactly. We want to do an eastern seaboard tour, you know, and hit multiple locations. So we'd love to join up with you, Mark, and your network as well when we're out there.
Excellent. Sounds good. See you soon.
All right. Well, good luck and thanks for your work in the world. It's making a difference.
You too. Talk soon.
Okay.